money. I can board liaison, Vanda.
Hello? No? Hello?
Yes.
Hello? It's working or not? Don't look like. Hello? Yeah. Finally. Thank you. Good morning for everybody. Thanks to be in this section with us. Now, we have today, it's, let me organize the things here. So, we're going to have in this section, this very day-by-day issue that is in our lives, unhappily, in this time, you know, causing a lot of problems to the industry, to the users. And that's the idea, to debate a little bit what is the countries are facing and some technical issues. We're going to have two small sessions here. With three speakers in each one. So we're going to start having some challenge that Colombia is faced. Then we're going to have some analysis about fishing cases in Brazil and abuse of DNS. And after that, we have a more technical section about the reputation of DNS. So that's the first part of this session. And after that, we're going to have some open session from questions and answer. And we'll be glad to take. And also, we have remote participation. That personally, as member of a public participation committee, I'm glad that we can offer this facility to our colleagues that's not present today in this session. So, to start, we're going to have here Mr. Schaeffer, who is that's a criminal investigation from the investigator from the criminal investigation department of Interpol in Colombia, that will share some challenge that Colombia is facing nowadays in this issue. Please, Schaeffer, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Buenos dias.
Good morning. Very quickly, we are going to have an overview of the challenges that Colombia is facing today. But you will notice that they are not very different than what we see worldwide. Basically, ICANN as an organization, in this case, requires from Colombia, for being the host country, also to say what they face at this moment and what the strengths are in the research and investigation precisely. So first we are going to address the challenges. The Colombian police force that is investigating cyber crimes, we have a scale of the top 10 the top 10 trends that are taking place in Colombia, and you will realize that we are investigating out of these 10, more than 50% have to do with that report, with that abuse, with that replacement of identities, with that theft of identity in the web. First, we have theft by e-transfer or e-wire, phishing, farming, spoofing. I know that are terminology that you are very well familiar with. And so we are investigating at this moment easy money offer and for job offers in the country, which are fake or via internet through the use of companies' domain names or providers that are not precisely making any requests via internet, but they are doing it to make this replacement online. We also have the SMission, which are short text messages through the telephone companies or providers, and the mobile lines, where allegedly great big companies are delivering premiums, prices in cash in some occasions, and they also make this replacement of big companies, of big corporations in mobile services, of large marketplaces, etc. This is happening very frequently. The identity replacement or phishing with social networks, profiles in internet at the corporate level and an individual level, on a free level, all of this is taking place. This identity theft is also one of the focuses that we are having at this moment. Also the sale of databases. Bogota is not alien to pursuing corporate databases through spammers that Colombian spammers are gathering all the information of domain names and selling those databases. So we are going to see how easy taking a domain name and stealing it is. Also, a spy and data theft is very frequent in the industry for the replacement. Also, malware, trojans, viruses, Colombian websites of critical infrastructure, government, education that have been hacked. And in their hosting, in their .com domain, in their servers, have had phishing lines hosted, which enables Colombian criminals to use them as their phishing platforms. Hacking and sabotage also takes place in websites, for example, India state websites. So it is interesting to the coordination and the role that this coordination with the .com domains plays. And the content crimes have to do with social networks and emails that basically have to do with the cyberbullying that is to entrust a bad reputation to individuals, but this is not made in a physical way as it happened in high school or but virtually, electronically. And so they are 24 hours a day damaging the good name and the good reputation, etc. And also then we have grooming, which has to do with sexual predators that use internet and the anonymous names that it offers, pretending they are younger people to obtain sexual encounters with underage people. These are the trends that the National Police is currently investigating, and as you can notice, seven or eight of them have to do with this abuse of internet and with the replacement of the domain as well. Organizations, criminal organizations that have been identified at this moment in Colombia, we can notice that they are organizations with defined roles. Each one of the individuals know how to do their role. It's very hard to get to the leaders, to the heads of these organizations, because they are anonymous behind the internet as a platform. And as investigators, we need to begin with the weakest chain, with the weakest because they receive that money from the transfer in some occasions. So we need to begin with the most difficult part. And in some occasions, very, very seldom we get to the leaders or of the attacks. The problems and the question that still remains as a problem, because to us it's a problem, and for the ordinary citizen, we need more effective communication protocols, fastest connections. Everyone is claiming for that, but we need to make internet available in a very wide or broadband connection, because this would impede constant attacks. Second problem is storage. People identify three essential components to buy technology: higher processing, higher speed, and higher capacity. One individual with a 500 giga capacity equipment very, very hardly will get to that storage, very, very hard. And to us, this is a problem, because as a national police force, when we sees those elements and we need to analyze those elements in a forensic way, we need to make an exact copy. We can never work on the original, and this entails that we need lots of storage capacity to make those copies, and to us this becomes a problem. But to the end user, well, that is the best that can happen. To them is a benefit. Also, low prices to access to new technologies. As from 2007 in Colombia, and anyone interested in purchasing an equipment below 1.7 million Colombian pesos will not pay taxes, and this opened the market to technologies. So for end users, this is something good. And we find people without studies, with a good connection, have all the tools available to become potential hackers, because everything is on the internet. Everything is available on the internet. People using internet as an information means, but they find other contents, and they become potential hackers. And the second problems, or one of the many problems that we fail, 980 million of illegal files in the networks. This is something very complicated to us to make that legal follow-up, because of crime trends that are a crime in Colombia but not in other countries. So you well know what this means. These are networks that effectively here we have detected that they offer a service, an exchange file service, that they are being used to find vulnerable equipments and submit them to botnets. And we have plenty of equipment or in Colombia that had been submitted to this botnet. DNS attacks, we are not alien to this. At this moment, this is a clear example in the national registry where the elections for the president took place. It was precisely attacked on the very same day of the election. Colombia is not alien to this kind of attack, of hacking. Our website was used for phishing in one opportunity, so we need to struggle, we need to fight against this. These are domains, .gov, these are the pages that crime or cyber criminals attack most frequently. I could provide over hundreds of examples at this moment of what we are currently doing for this kind of investigation. Phishing and spoofing is a very simple example. I reviewed it because of the so many pages available on the internet. And you can see on the top the email address, cartagena2010@icann, and it doesn't exist. I made it up at the moment of replacing. I sent it to my corporate account, an email with a link that obviously would send me or redirect me to another part with a photograph that could have a malicious code. There's nothing we can do against it. So if somebody is trying to identify if this is real, something real or a replacement, so we should look at the whole heading. And because of a cultural matter, we don't do that. We only review the headings in order to determine what is real and what is fake. And in this email and the free email, it's not identified if there is a malware there. And that nick is going to take me to a phishing site, and the attachment could include malware. And we are fighting against this. Basically, it's a war, that an endless war. And what do criminal hackers need? They want information. If we take a look at the picture, if you receive this email where it says that if at this moment you do not resend this email, your 15 main topics is going to be there next to your bed. I will do that. This is what they basically do to obtain that information of your 15 main contacts, because it's very impressive, or because they personalize this kind of email. So people open this kind of email indiscriminately of phishing, spoofing, etc. The strength that the National Colombian Police Force has at this moment will be became effective 2 years ago with the IT Act for crimes. We had only 2 years ago one single article in the criminal code to criminalize this kind of crimes, but now we have 10 different criminal categories, access, abuse, IT system, that you can have an idea of what these articles undertake. 10 articles, illegitimate of hindering of in IT system, interception of IT data. I mean, they are very broad in order to the fill the technological gap. And so we cannot say that this is obsolete from 5 years from now, just informatic or IT damage, malicious malware, violation of personal data, replacement of websites to capture personal data. There are some aggravating circumstances when that replacement is made on critical infrastructure. This is one of the aggravations for these crimes. And two, connected with the financial, which is to do with theft and non-consented transfer of assets. We have 10 new criminal categories with a penalty of at least 4 years imprisonment, and this is a strength that we currently have, and it did not exist 2 years ago, and they became effective on January 5, 2009. In the same way, we have two articles in the Criminal Code of Procedure to recover internet information through other technological means to produce equivalent effect. So all electronic devices have the power to make the seizure and the analysis and also the anything that could be seized from the transfer of files via the internet. That is where the that co-domain plays a significant role, because we need that cooperation, that international cooperation, and we will find places, sites that will be launched anywhere worldwide. And we have another article that enables emails, telex, telefax as evidence. Even though this is intangible, we can use this as an evidence for a trial, for example. And a website that is at this moment works as a platform with an interactive chat, so that any citizen, companies, and financial entities, when they are victims of hacking, they can immediately report it to us and we can make the follow-up. That, or being the first respondent and tackle it in a very fast way. What are the challenges? For 2011, 2012, to have the coverage of technological coverage total country-wise with the 44 main cities in the country with 8 IT forensic IT labs on a national level. We now have 5 in place in Medellin, Barranquilla, Cali, Bucaramanga, and Bogota. And centrally, we have the investigation, the criminal investigation lab. And internationally, we are working with the working group of Latin America for technological crimes. And we also participate of the Ibero-American Forum of Cyber Police to have an online platform to file a complaint and let the individual use this online and provide the first response, and also the creation of the call cert, something that we've been working from 2008 to provide response to cyber attacks. And you can also see the address, Cibernetica Policia, that is a unit. We talk about a national or a domestic address with a platform for everything connected with child pornography. Those are our challenges for 2011, 2012, and also to process digital evidence. We have no problems with physical evidence, and we are strongly working to make a processing of the evidence on a digital side of cloud computing, which is the information on the internet, and that is where we are addressing nationally now. Anything that may be available physically, if it is intangible, we can make it available as well. Our contact information, we are going to provide them in the presentation, and that is all we wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. As he said, we are going to continue now with the presentation by Christine Hoppers. Christine is the computer emergency response team from Brazil.
Yeah. And Christine, please, she was talking about the DNS abuse and phishing case. Christine, please, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Vanda. I will talk a little bit about the phishing cases we handled in Brazil this year. So CertPR is the national CCERT for Brazil. So we handle all incidents and computer security incidents related to Brazilian networks. The data I'll be talking here is basically from complaints we received about phishing cases hosted in Brazil or hosted abroad affecting Brazilian brands and Brazilian banks or e-commerce sites or other institutions that are being targeted by phishing. And in this year, we received a total of a little bit more than 7,000 complaints. This means not emails complaining, but exactly about URLs that were new to us that were hosting phishing sites. So this is not, here I don't have statistics about malware because this we handle as a different statistic. So I'm not talking about URLs hosting malware. I'm only talking about URLs hosting fake web pages and content relating to phishing attacks themselves. Most of the attacks, they were targeting Brazilian brands that were complaining to us and CCing us to help to take down the content. But we received almost 2,000 complaints about international brands that had some phishing cases hosted in Brazil. And what we see is that there is no one-to-one rule or any connection between IPs and domain names and ccTLDs. We have all the cases basically just spread all over the world. We had more than 68 countries that were hosting those content. So we get the IP allocation data from the regional internet registries data. So we are just getting to which country those IPs were located. What we see is that we had in a total of 92 ccTLDs. So there are a lot of domains that are not exactly like being hosted at IPs at the same country where the ccTLD is. So the abuse of a ccTLD is not related directly to where the content is located according to IP addresses. And we had like 10 gTLDs involved this year in phishing attacks. And we still have a pretty significant number of phishing cases, that's 500, a little bit more, that are just hosted in IP addresses. There is no domain name at all. One of the things talking about IP allocations, of course, people from all over the world, they just complain to us about things hosted in Brazil. So most of the people that complain about something hosted in Brazil, we receive that. So this is roughly 35%. But most of the cases affecting Brazilian brands are hosted in U.S. And if you look at the table on the right, you can see that the AS, the autonomous systems involved in hosting this, are basically hosting companies. So when we go to these hosting companies, it's not like the criminals are actually paying for the services. They are most of the times they are just compromising websites that are being hosted in big data centers. So what we are seeing is that there are a lot of data centers in U.S. and a lot in Brazil and some other countries too, but they are not really the biggest majority. So it's very spread, mainly where they can find a vulnerable web application, they just compromise the sites and put the data online. But getting into the data about DNS abuse, what we were seeing, we had domains used for hosting phishing in 10 gTLDs. The majority was .com, so it's also the majority of domains that we have in gTLDs. But if you go to, we dig into how many of those almost 2,000 domains were actually created for phishing, like with the name of a brand or the name of a bank, that is just 80. That's not really the biggest majority that we are seeing. We are seeing that most are just like domains that are hosting content are being compromised, the website, and then they host a phishing in a subdomain or in a rel in the main web page. So this is mostly what we are seeing. And we saw also created domains just in .com, .net, .org, info, and biz. So this is where it's going. But although it is a low number, one of the problems that we have is how to contact the registrar or the reseller and try to explain to them that that is actually a domain that's being used for phishing. And so what we see is that sometimes those domains, they last for a few weeks and they change IP addresses because most of the time it's just that they don't understand. They don't know what are the brands affecting Brazil. They don't know exactly who we are and what we are talking. So mainly is a communication problem with people that are actually registering the domains for them to get the domain down and to take some action into that. And if we go to ccTLDs, the number are not too different from the ccTLDs, from the gTLDs. We have a lot of complaints in .br, but basically there are a lot of complaints of Brazilian sites compromised by people abroad and hosting phishing in Brazil. So we were looking at how many domains were created in .br that were actually related to brands or campaigns, and those were 53. And they basically were just created and taken down in the same day because our process is very quick from how to do that. I was talking to people there. We saw an interesting thing that Italy, Russia, and France, they had a lot of domains that I would say like they had brands in it, but they were all in a free hosting service. So a free hosting service was actually attracting more than actually someone registering the domain. So it was not a domain registered, but they were abusing free hosting on those ccTLDs to create pages and names that actually look like names of the brands. And another thing that we are seeing that is really increasing is the abuse of those short URL services for phishing attacks. And basically because the end user don't know exactly where the URL begins and where you start having like directories for them, everything that just starts with bank.com.br is basically their bank. So they don't understand that if you have a dot, it's not the same as if you have a slash. So basically it's how to understand the domain name. So what we are seeing is that like the Bitly, the Path2, TinyCC, the Migrimi is a word in Portuguese that would say, like, migrate me, so put me somewhere else. So those are very popular services. But basically, they're just abusing the understanding of the end user. And talking more about the abuse of the DNS infrastructure, per se, I would say that we are not receiving reports of DNS cache poisoning. That doesn't exactly mean that they're not happening. Probably they are in some sort, but what we are seeing is that at least in Brazil, attackers are still very focused on delivering malware that alters the host's file of the end user machine. So I wouldn't call that a cache poisoning because you're not actually poisoning the cache. You're just like changing their file and preventing the user from actually going to the internet infrastructure. And the other thing is that most of the times when we see a recursive DNS server actually serving wrong answers, you had someone actually compromising that server. You can see that the response is authoritative, that you actually have someone putting his own file in there and controlling very well when that zone file is up and when is not. And usually it goes like for weekends or during the night. That's the time that you don't have like operators taking care and looking. And it's very difficult, for example, for investigators to go in there because then they make the queries and know it's responding okay. So then when they investigate the fraud of the client, the zone is not up anymore. So there is a lot of confusion in the investigation process. So basically this is what is being used for crime. Something that's not really related, just an end comment for abuse of DNS for crime or phishing or the abuse of DNS, but we are seeing a lot, is still the abuse of open recursive DNS servers for DDoS attacks. So this is not related to creating domains per se, but actually to abusing poor configured machines to create DDoS attacks. So basically, this is some data I have in the trends. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. We come back with some questions later. So now we're going to have Ms. João Damas. João is from ISC. João, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sarvanda. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about reputational DNS. It'll be for the introduction and explanation of what it is about. Can we get the next slide, please? Oh, sorry. Silly me. Sorry about that. So everyone is probably familiar with the concept of DNS reputation as applied to email services, where you subscribe or not, as you choose, to databases of hosts that you should be accepting or not email from, and that is delivered to your mail server via the DNS. This has been around for a while. It's also been applied to recursive DNSs in specialized code at some ISPs. What's new with the reputational DNS now is the announcement we did in late July about response policy zones, what we call response policy zones, which is basically a common framework for the exchange of DNS reputation information to name servers. At the bottom there, you'll see a link. It's a bit gray, hard to read, but the presentation is uploaded to the site. But there's a blog entry by Paul Vixie explaining a little bit of what the goal here is and how we are going to go about it. So, briefly, what is RPZ, the Response Policy Zones? It's DNS policy information inside the DNS itself. It's an open common mechanism that allows producers of domain reputation data and the consumers of that data to cooperate in the application of that as policy in the recursive name servers that you have access to. And it does this in real time. So you'd be affecting, altering, or modifying the stream of recursive DNS lookups at your recursive server in real time. So basically, it turns the DNS server into one more very powerful policy tool. Examples of what you could use this to? Well, for instance, you could use this to block or redirect malicious sites to wherever you want. Block the ability of bots to find the command and control if that address becomes known. You could quarantine infected clients to make them aware of the situation they are in and how to possibly fix their problems, help them, instead of propagating the problem further. And of course, the DNS is flexible enough to also carry IPv4, IPv6 information. Basically, that was it. It's a very simple mechanism. The idea is not entirely new. It's a very parallel to what we are doing these days in SMTP. It's just that it applies to DNS, and it applies to recursive name servers and in real time. It provides an additional tool. We can discuss this later. I think the overview is quite enough for now. If you have any questions, we can take them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So let's open the floor for questions. And I'll start to ask Margie if there is some feedback from the remote participation. No? If it's not, the floor is open. There is any question from people? Come over. Please identify yourself for the scribes.
Hello, I'm Scott Pinzon, part of ICANN's staff. I think the idea of reputational DNS is fascinating. I'm curious to find out how the system would handle false positives so that someone who may look shady from a DNS perspective, such as a legitimate mass mailer or something, doesn't wind up getting identified as or blocked.
Well, whenever you use reputational data, the source of that data is very important, right? Just like it is with when you apply it to email. So in the case of false positives, if one gets through for whatever reason, what you'd probably be seeing is a block. And the block would occur at ISP level. So if it is in fact a false positive, the ISP then has the power within reach of his own tools to alter that behavior without having to wait necessarily to get the information amended at the source. There will be mistakes like with anything. There's no way around it. The thing you have to think about, I think, is cost benefit. What do you get? How much trouble can you avoid versus how much trouble you are potentially going to create? But it does put control into the hands of the ISP, which is usually the organization that's closer to the customer, right, and has a direct relationship with the customer. So I think it's a more effective place to be than if the information is being or the action is being controlled by an organization that is somewhat stuck to move.
Thank you. And if I just one little follow-up. Is there possible to estimate at this time what level of monitoring it would require from ISPs, for example? I mean, it wouldn't be a full-time job for someone, I'm assuming, or would it?
No, we don't. I don't think anyone anticipates this to be a full-time job for anyone. It will be one more item that that ISPs would be adding to their regular operations. But again, it depends on how good or not so good is the reputation. The source of reputation information is, right? That's a crucial part. The better it gets, the less trouble it causes, and the happier everyone is.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Rod Rasmussen with Internet Identity. Two things. I wanted to follow up on the RPZ question there, because there's actually, we're implementing RPZ reputation, publishing that kind of data for blocking or sinkholing or what have you. There, on the question that was just asked, there actually is a start of authority record possibility for showing the source of the list data. So if there's a false positive, you can actually track it back to the organization that published it in the first place. So there's a way of actually, if you're a end user that thinks that you've been blocked inappropriately, you can actually figure out who's blocking you and contact them directly. So it's a very powerful thing. I had a question or comment or what have you on the information that Christine brought up on the hacking of recursive name servers and host file exploits on the end user PC. We had a big session on DNSSEC yesterday. I believe, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong here, DNSSEC would not help in either of those cases because you have control of the host file on the computer. It would never reach out and check the DNSSEC record. And even on the recursive server, if you control what it's doing, it would not get that DNSSEC record either. So that, you know, unfortunately, DNSSEC doesn't really cover those possibilities. Can I get a comment on that or just a confirmation or on that?
Just confirm, yeah, that's one of the biggest problems that we are having, that doesn't matter what you do, you just lose control. So even if you have like a reputation service, it doesn't matter because the user is compromised. If you're using DNSSEC, even the intruder could sign with DNSSEC in your own recursive and kind of show that is signed, because you never reach the bank or the MasterCard or whatever that's being fake. So it's really a big problem because the DNSSEC doesn't cover exactly that. And that's what we are seeing in Brazil, is the major problem is actually the host file and the end user. It's not really compromises of the zones happened 2 times in big providers, so that was a big impact. But then actually most of the malwares is just like is day-to-day for them. It's just go there, put his own file in the host file, and they block everything, AVs, and sometimes they don't even, they have a loopback for like Google DNS or something like that. So you can never reach other things because they actually put hundreds of files in there.
Just a follow up on that. Are you seeing any malware that's doing basically replacing the recursive servers with basically criminal recursive servers instead of the ones that the ISP would provide, because we see that in other locales.
No, we haven't seen that. That could be possible, but we haven't seen. We see that they are even like changing the addresses of the big hosting service because they want to get your username and password to host phishing in the hosting site. So they're really using the host file to do all the types of man in the middle or something like that with attacks. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
I mean, it's certainly possible. It's not too hard to write and embed as lightweight resolver in any piece of software like this. I mean, they already do things that are a lot more sophisticated than that. And libraries that allow you to build resolvers are very easy. I haven't seen any that does this yet, but it's just a matter of time, I think. And I just wanted to add something about your question about the NSSEC. Well, the NSSEC does what it does very well, but it's definitely not the cure for world hunger, right? It protects the information in transit from the source to the consumer, and that it does very well. If the information that's injected into the system is not valid, or the consumer is not behaving, or its behavior has been altered, then you're out of luck. Yeah, that's outside what the NSSEC protects.
Yeah, and that wasn't a criticism of DNSSEC that I was trying to point out there. It's just that it doesn't solve that problem, and some people might assume that it does. Thanks.
Can I go ahead?
Yeah, please. My question is for Mr. Ruiz, so I will make it in Spanish.
My question is to Mr. Ruiz. I will make it in Spanish. I'm Anthony Harris. I'm the executive director of the Argentine Internet Chamber. We operate in the Internet Exchange in Argentina and the connection, and we are also in the process of implementing a C-cert, that is a cert for the private sector. What we have been hearing from the technology providers in cyber crimes is that the key problem, the key issue is that the ignorance, the lack of knowledge in general of the end users with respect to anything that may happen just for being online. For example, they spoke about hundreds of thousands of PCs hacked, infected by the cyber hackers. Nobody is aware of that, and it seems that it would take, according to their explanation, as a very intensive awareness and training campaign for users at a comprehensive level. So my question is if you have faced this aspect in Colombia and what your opinion is about it. Thank you. Yes, in fact, as I mentioned before, this is happening worldwide. I think that no country is alien to this. The issues we tackle, just for the user to have a PC and a connection, and it seems enough. I mean, learning, training, they need to begin to use it. And the easier the operating system is, the better. And fighting against this is something cultural, social, is very hard. As national police, we are unable to make it, but companies affected, for example, the financial sector, in fact, they are making strong advertising investments to make these trends aware, like saying, do not provide information if somebody asks your data on the internet or via email. We would not be able to make it because we could create economic panic in the financial sector. Do not use virtual financial portals. That is something that we cannot make. We try to provide statistics saying that this is a trend that is taking place in Colombia or in any other place in the world. We could be victims and be involved, and the national administration, as from this year, is strongly working and making a very significant investment in advertising to make all these trends known. And we look forward that with the consolidation of our cert, we will be able to materialize that information and make the information massive. We are also working in that. We are making it. Thank you very much. Well, my question is also addressed to you, Mr. Ruiz. I'm Jordi Aguilar. I am the founder of La Caixa, that is the first saving bank of Spain. I am in the board of directors of FIRST and of the working group. And in Europe, we have seen the need to create intelligent exchange networks between the banking sector and the law enforcement to face the most complicated challenges, not only phishing, but hackers that are oriented to attack critical infrastructures that, for example, are very important to the countries of the European Union and to the Union itself. So I just was wondering if there are similar initiatives in America, in Latin America, in place for the creation of intelligence networks on a periodic basis for the exchange of intelligence between the attack that the private sector suffers and the enforcement and the police or the individuals that are devoted to the national defense. Thank you. Yes, in fact, this is something we are currently working on. We are working with the embassies in to sign mutual legal assistance agreements with different government agencies for that approach. We are fully available, and we are also to enforce our law 24/7 for the exchange through the Interpol office and have a very fast exchange and a full cooperation to get that volatile evidence with any ISP or .co domain could otherwise be quickly lost. So we are fully available and we are currently working on that. We are open to any request and we are pursuing those agreements through the Latin American Working Group and through different stages. Thank you very much. I also know that Brazil has a strong protection group with the police force. They are strongly connected with the Mercosul, that is the Southern Common Market, with the United States and with Europe, and I think that with the whole Latin American continent, and they are exchanging opinions and information on security. And so we held a session short ago, and this was the most important session on international cooperation. Thank you very much. If I may take advantage to ask Margie if there is anybody else. So if you let me, I will ask to Mr. Jeffer about the act, the law, because we are all working. There is an act, a law in Brazil that is still a bill in the Congress, but a very significant fact is that we are really struggling if there is anything in your law bill about the information for the ISP, how to retrieve that information, how long that is going to take. If you have information, I would be pleased to know about it. In this moment, as there is a Information and Data Protection Act and another law that was recently enacted, that is the ABIA data law, that defines what information is private and what information is public, and everything regarding the companies that store that information and how to provide that information. As investigators of cyber crimes, we, in order to have access to that information of ISPs, we need a prior consent of a guarantee judge to request that information. So all of this is included in that ABS data law that protects the holders. So this is not public unless a judge allows me to access to that information. The Ministry of LASTIC is working in the amendment of this act we have a telecommunication act, but that act is more focused to telephony, and the internet side is still behind. So the progress we have seen in telecommunications is focused now in the internet, and we are working to regulate and have that information available. Information is available then, but we have not still accomplished to know for how long this information will be and how it will be provided. We receive the information subject to reviews and controls regarding people's or individuals' privacy and their timelines, but we have not still enacted a law to let us know for how long that information should be stored in order to provide it. And so we are currently working on that. We still don't know their timelines, but the information is available. Well, thank you. I am going...
It's part of this meeting, and I would like to thank you, all the speakers. Please applaud. Thank you. And I will call Jacqueline Morris. That's the next moderator of the second part of the session. From my side, thank you very much for your attention, and let's continue. Jacqueline, please. Passo mis e-mails, porque esto es un problema que tiene implicaciones financieras, ¿no? Porque los ISPs muchos son chicos.
Exactamente. ¿No?
Y guardar toda la información, pero todavía son los más vulnerables.
Okay, great. Hi, everyone. My name is Jacqueline Morris, and I'll be moderating this session. This portion of the panel is about the ESSAC's Registrant's Guide to Protecting Domain Registration Accounts. We have Richard Willem from Network Solutions and the ESSAC, who will take us through that guide, and then we'll have some reactions from Evan Leibovich from the ALAC and the at-large group, and from Max Sulin from Mark Monitor. So I guess might as well just, Richard, take it away.
Sure. Thank you very much. We'll, if you could, there we go. I'll throw the slides up, controller. The ESSAC is the ICANN's Security and Stability Advisory Committee, and it's a group of technical experts from all over the globe that advise the board on security matters, and so we undertake various projects, and this was one of the ones that we took under, and it's about advising registrants about what they need to do to protect their registration accounts. It's a follow-on to an essay, a paper that was written by the ESSAC called SAC 040040, and that was more targeted at registrars, and it came about after there were a few high-profile account compromises that resulted in various high-profile registrants losing control of their domain names and those having a sort of bad things happen, if you will. So we set about doing this to really kind of point this more at registrants themselves. And in this paper, we go over and we spend some time looking at the threat landscape, and then we talk about what registrants should be doing when they're as registrant account holders to help them protect their data. And we go and provide folks some guidance on how to go about some questions they can ask about choosing a registrar, because there is a lot of choice in the marketplace, and different registrars fill different areas of that marketplace. So the paper was published within the last month or so, and there's a URL for it up on the ICANN website under this section. I mercifully do not have that URL memorized, so I won't and try and make the moderator put it into the transcript. So it's about 30 pages or so, and you can read about that at your leisure on the plane ride home. So the first thing that we talk about in this paper is we go over the threat landscape, and it's sort of the biggest and most obvious threat is just losing control of your account credentials, right? You have a password and someone compromises it, they guess it, or you have it written down somewhere, or maybe someone runs a password cracker against it, and your account credentials can just get lost. Sort of if this happens, if you're lucky, the thing that they will do is change your password and try and lock you out, because that's actually, if they do that, that's actually a good thing, because then you'll probably find out about it. More sinister things that can happen are they can go in and start changing your DNS, sort of change your contact info, move your DNS around on the internet, and it could keep, everything could keep working fine, and then one day you could wake up and try to go renew your name, or perhaps you had it set on auto-renew, and lo and behold, you find out that your name is not renewed, and some things have happened that you've lost control of the name, and then you sort of are in a world of hurt, I guess you'd say, because perhaps your email's not working, maybe your website's down, or perhaps it's more importantly, depending on your business, you might be an e-commerce company, and some other people can do things to damage your online reputation. So, and these threats are changing and evolving constantly. Even actually, as we were writing the paper, things were changing about. So, what can you do as a registrant? Well, the sort of obvious thing is, you know, choose strong passwords, and everybody kind of knows about that. But one of the things that we identify in the paper is that really folks should be using the communications that they get on a schedule from their registrars as a way to help ascertain that they are still, in fact, in control of the name, that the registrar believes that you are still in control of that name, and that's why they're sending you email. So consequently, it kind of runs counter to some people's intuition, which is to, oh, these emails from my registrar are just spam, and so I really want to unsubscribe from all their lists. We're encouraging people to look hard at that perhaps knee-jerk reaction and consider maintaining some of those maintaining those subscriptions such that you can identify important correspondence from your registrar as being a signal that you are still in control of the name. Maintaining ownership proof, everybody's sort of used to printing out receipts and things like that when they are having paperwork for an important purchase, like you probably know where the title is for your car. But one of the things that we have identified is that maintaining proof of ownership in the form of receipts from your registrar purchase and things like that is important when you get involved in a dispute. You want to have that in a safe and secure location, but more importantly, a known location that you can access it quickly and without scrambling around. Because if you lose control of your name and someone takes the email, your email that away from you, you are likely going to be in a hurry to get it back. And that is probably not the time to go rooting through that stack of paper that's on your credenza. Maybe Matt might be more organized, but I certainly have a stack of paper on my credenza. And so maintaining those in an organized fashion, just like you do the title of your car, is very useful. We also talk about diversifying points of contact and implementing change controls. In larger companies, these are sort of standard things that companies do. They're used to setting up mechanisms whereby when someone leaves the company or by when there's changes being made, that there are processes and controls around these things. We're really encouraging registrants of all sizes to adopt some of these processes. And you may not need a lot of bigger companies have big change control systems and very complicated sorts of things. you don't need all those sorts of big systems to do a passable job at doing change control around. For example, when someone leaves your company, you're already pretty good at making sure they don't get paid. That's sort of a typical thing that people do when they leave their company. But you also should be looking at, does this person have control of any domain names or any registrant accounts, and how do we keep those in the hands of the company itself as opposed to in the hands of individuals. I know I've been personally involved in a number of disputes at our company, not involved, but sort of helping to resolve, and probably Matt has too, where names are registered by an individual at the company, and then that person sort of takes the names away from the company, almost treating them like a personal asset. And this can cause a lot of companies great distress, and it can lead to a fair bit of litigation. So, we also talk about encouraging users to be proactive in their monitoring, in other words, not waiting for something bad to happen before you actually go and check. So you can go and monitor the who is in the DNS, and if you are a programmer can do this sort of stuff pretty simply, but there are also free services on the web and also companies that will monitor these things for you for a fee. We encourage people to look at what their contact data looks like, where their name servers, how they're configured. See when was the last time that your domain data was changed. Sort of like if you log in on online banking, at least when I log in on my accounts, you see a thing at the top that says, oh, you last logged in on this date, and it might even give you a geolocation of the IP address where you logged in from. And that sort of thing can be a good reminder to help people understand when and where they were, to make sure that their account wasn't compromised and someone sort of logging in from some bad place and at a dark 30 in the morning. So account protective measures, oops. It's red is down, green is go. There we go. So, and then lastly, as you're looking at prospective registrars, you know, we offer a list of questions that you can ask registrars, and because there are a wide variety of them, and you can ask them things about their security measures. You can do research about their reputation, talk to some of their other customers, because your relationship with the registrar is very important, because these domain names that you have in your account are very important assets to your business or to your personal life. So I think that's the last of my slides here. And so I don't know how we're doing this next. So I'll just turn it back.
Okay, thanks a lot. I would say, Evan, if you want to talk about the user perspective.
Okay. Good morning. I didn't bring any slides with me, so you're going to have to listen to me. Sorry. I'm coming in from at large, which means I have the perspective, supposedly, of the internet end user. And also in my day job, I'm involved with consulting services to small businesses. I also work with a major university in Toronto. And so I'll give some of the perspective I have from them. For friends, family, and myself, I manage a portfolio of a whopping 17 domains. That makes me a domainer in their eyes, but probably a speck of dust in the world of domainers. So I'm comfortably in the middle, I guess. What I'd just like to do, first of all, is congratulate Richard and the SAC on the document. I've read it. It's in plain English. I really hope that every single registrar puts it on their website along with their Internet 101 that they give to their customers or make available. It really should be required reading. It's a really, really good piece of consumer self-education that I really like the language of it. It's clear, it's understandable, and I would really, to any registrars in the room, please put this on your website. It's going to make your registrants more educated and smarter, and that's going to be good all around. Some of the stuff that, the obvious things, I'm not going to repeat what Richard said. I'm just going to offer perhaps a couple of extra tidbits, one of which is to encourage registrants to be very, very familiar with the particular dashboard of the registrar they're using. That's something that will help them manage things like auto renewal, that will help them make sure that they've got good, clean content information, and can also make sure that they're notified if anyone tries to make any kind of modification, you know, along with the geolocation that you mentioned and so on. But that dashboard differs, of course, from registrar to registrar, and I would just simply want to put out as a piece of best practice, please, to make sure people are very familiar with whatever particular software that a registrar is using or has developed internally. The other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of registrants, when they first go in, especially individuals and small businesses, don't realize that a domain has multiple contact links, not just one. So there's an owner, and depending on the TLD, there'll be a technical contact, an admin contact, a billing contact, and so on. A lot of people don't take advantage of this, and they really should. I'll give some the main concrete example is actually one that was raised yesterday in a session of, I think, a restaurant in Colombia that got a web designer to do a sort of all-in-one package, and the web design was really good, and the website was really good. And then they went into the Whois, and they saw that the owner's name was registered to the web designer. The person making the presentation thought that was a good thing in terms of an all-in-one solution. I was bothered by that because if you have a technical contact, most TLDs have a place for the technical contact. But that is not the same as the owner of the domain. And if there's any kind of a dispute between the owner of the domain and a service provider, be a web designer or hosting provider or anything like that, it's really important that the owner of the domain assert that ownership and make sure that they're listed as the main owner. Another instance where I've run into this is hosting services that say, well, if you host with us for so long, you get your domain for free. And then they turn around and realize, well, the hosting service has maintained ownership on the domain. So if the company wants to go to a different hosting service, they can't necessarily take the domain with them. It's one thing to port your website to another site, but if the hosting service won't let you take that domain with you, that ends up being problematic. And so we encourage people to make sure that they know the nature of that sort of bundling that they're getting, that they continue to maintain ownership of the domain regardless of who is doing their hosting. Those are really the main things that I just wanted to draw attention to. The rest of this is simply being a good consumer as a registrant and doing the same kind of consumer research that you would do for buying any kind of goods, whether it's, you know, shopping for a car, shopping for an ISP, shopping for a computer supplier, or anything like that. Being a smart consumer, just doing basics of research, and using the kind of information mapped out in SEC 44 is really a phenomenal start, I think, in helping people make good decisions. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thanks a lot. Matt?
Thanks, Jacqueline. And I just want to thank Margie for, again, putting together this forum. Margie, this is the sixth. And, you know, we spend a lot of time during the week at ICANN meetings talking about policy issues. And the thing that I really appreciate about these sessions, that these are real-world kind of operational kind of things to discuss, and I appreciate that we have the forum to do that. So, like Evan, I did not prepare slides as well, so Rick has all the slides for us. But I wanted to take just a couple minutes and compliment the ESSEC on the report. Mark Monitor is an ICANN-accredited registrar, but we work only with large corporations, and so we have a very unique perspective because our clients often are the targets of some of these hijacking attempts. But, you know, I want to be clear that this isn't just a corporate issue. This is an issue that affects individuals that have domain names registered. And, you know, for those of you that don't think that this is a real-world scenario, there actually was a recent case where a domain portfolio owner actually had his, had his account credentials compromised by some malware that was installed on his machine, similar to what you talk about in the report. So a third party was able to access the account at the registrar, update the DNS, transfer the domains away. So The ESSAC report that was issued really goes to the core of things that we see in real life scenarios day in and day out. So kudos to the ESSAC for again putting forth a great report. And you know, the threat landscape has changed over time. The thing that I sort of rely on is that the measures that we have, the countermeasures to those threats, have changed as well. So the ESSAC report talks a lot about some of the measures that you can take, things like two-factor authentication, things like registry lock that are now available to guard against the threats that we have that weren't available several years ago. So I think as a community and as you know, registrars and registries, we've really sort of come together to make sure that we're addressing the threats that are out there, and we're changing the technology and our processes to allow us to have better safeguards for registrants around the world. And really, you know, I also want to drive home the fact that this is not just a registrar issue or a registry issue. I think we all have skin in the game here, and it's up to all of us, registrants, registries, and registrars, to all make sure that we have best practices, that we're educating, you know, our staffs and our customers about what it means to have good security, and the fact that domain names are a target. And so if you're anyone, whether you're an individual that's running a blog site or a small business site or a large corporation that your whole business is online, you know, it's incumbent upon you to make sure that you're paying attention to your security. And that's really all that I have. We wanted to keep it brief and make sure that we left time for questions and opened it up to the audience as well.
Great, thanks. So are there any questions from the audience or from our remote participation?
Hi, my name's Bruce Tonkin, and I work for a fairly large registrar, Melbourne IT. Just a comment, Evan, when you're talking about ownership versus admin contacts and things, that comes to the crux of a lot of the issues that we have around domain names is a lack of understanding of the different roles and the lack of a consistent use of the who is entries to document what those roles are. In the early days, there was, particularly I'm talking about .com, they had an admin, a technical contact, probably the two main contacts that were public. Often there's also a billing contact as well, which can be a little different. Now, the problem with the admin contact on its own is it's kind of typically assumed that you knew who the organisation was and who the owner was, so you didn't really document that separately. So if it was something like you know, a government department, or it was, you know, MIT University, if you had MIT.university and had MIT.edu and then it had the admin contact, it's pretty clear who the owner of that name was. So that was never really carefully documented. And the main thing was just making sure we knew who was the person that you would ring if you had a problem with a computer that was running that particular domain name. So that's really the early origins in that academic environment. Now what's transpired is that the ownership of names is often not clear. And the sort of thing you're talking about is a web developer builds a website on a domain. Who actually is, in a legal term, the registered name holder, the legal entity that holds that name? Often that's not very well done. And some CCTLDs do that very well. .au, for example, has very explicitly you have to identify not just the company that owns the domain name, but its legal identifier within Australia has to be included. So it's very clear who their owner is. And that makes it much easier to deal with disputes, because when someone rings up and says, hey, this is my name versus that name, you know, you can actually fall back on a company structure. There's legal documents they can provide. But for most of .com, that doesn't apply. So I think one of the things that ALAC could probably assist with from a user perspective is really being clear what are the things that need to be properly documented, certainly being clear who is actually the legal holder of the domain name ultimately. So usually that can be an individual if it's an individual name, but usually it's best to have the actual formal company name in there, that whatever it is incorporated, because that then has a legal framework behind it for managing disputes. Then the admin contact obviously can be someone at that company. It could be at their provider if they want to do that. That doesn't really matter. But the key thing is documenting ultimately who's got legal responsibility for that name. And by and large, that's very poorly done. I would say there's probably more than 50% of the entries in .com don't have that right, in that the actual proper owner of the name is not actually documented. And this goes then back to the security problems that we have, because we don't put any effort really into identifying who is ultimately accountable for the use of that name. Because WHOIS is actually a contact methodology. It's not a legal documentation for who holds the name. All it is a method for contacting people. Yet we're trying to use WHOIS as though it's an identity system, and it's not. I think we need to really clearly identify. There's two problems here. Who is the identity and who's accountable for the name and how's that documented? And the WHOIS for how do you contact someone if, you know, the domain name's not working today? Two very different purposes. At the moment, we've got that all crushed into one place, which is the WHOIS, and it's not even clear which element is doing what. The law enforcement community think the admin contacts the accountable owner. It is actually not. Very rarely is the accountable owner ever identified in the WHOIS. And that's the crux of a lot of the problems we see.
So, Bruce, are you going to help us with the documentation to do this? You're absolutely right. That kind of information does need to go out. And, you know, just as Matt had said, the chain goes all the way in the responsibility for keeping for the security. One of the initiatives for at large going forward is trying to define issues of, say, registrants' rights and responsibilities, and it's sort of, well, you're entitled to a certain level of security, but you have to do your part in order to maintain that chain and to build that. So I don't think you'll get any argument.
I'll take this moment to report from the chat room. Bob Connolly agrees with Bruce Tonkin that this is an issue and gave the example regarding a similar situation in that a website might be created by a college student. The college student leaves, and then its domain name expires, and there's no ability to really follow up and get the information clarified. So Bob's agreeing with the discussion here.
Hi, Rod Rasmussen. Just to follow up a little bit on what Bruce was talking about as well, another consideration here is privacy services. That adds another layer of obfuscation, telling who the actual owner is. And in theory, that privacy service might be able to help return and restore something that was hijacked, but it adds time, complications, et cetera. So that might be an interesting aspect. I saw it was not really covered in the paper as an issue. I'd like love to see that issue explored a bit more. That wasn't my main comment, though, was around, I wanted to, commend the paper. It was excellent work. I was very happy to see that come out in conjunction, I believe it was SAC 40, which talked about kind of the registrar side of things. One thing that was mentioned in passing in the paper is use of multi-factor authentication as a strong methodology for ensuring that domains can't be hijacked. Two thoughts on that. It would be really great to get kind of the information about who is providing those kinds of services out in the marketplace so people can actually make decisions on that, because it's fairly well-guarded secret as far as that goes. At least it has been up until recently. Second part on multi-factor is that the criminal element has done a very good job in the last year or so of defeating multi-factor authentication. So your standard tokens and things like that you get no longer protect you for transactional security. You actually need far more advanced things to like heuristics and user behavior and things like that to watch what's going on, because the bad guys want to steal money from the banks. Multi-factor has been pushed out by the banks. Bad guys get around that by basically taking over your computer through malware and running it from your computer. So your multi-factor, you still use it, but the bad guy is controlling what happens. So I'd love to hear comments on what the thoughts were. Was putting the paper together on that, those issues, and the availability of information about who's providing different authentication levels.
Yeah, thanks, Rod. So, a couple of things. It's a cat and mouse game, right? Like I talked about earlier, as the threats have changed, you know, we've all kind of adapted. And so I think that's going to continue. In terms of information, it's interesting, at least speaking from my perspective, you know, we don't, just speaking for Mark Monitor, we don't do a lot of publicity, like on our website, about security measures that we have in place, and that's very intentional. But we're a sort of niche player, you know. But I know that there are more sort of retail-facing registrars that do publish information about two-factor authentications available and things like that. I don't think there's a sort of centralized place where you can go and see, you know, every registrar that has different security features available or not available. But I know that I've seen several registrars that have, I think, actually even issued press releases that they've rolled out, you know, two-factor in their interface and things like that. So I think the information's out there, but it might not be out there in a sort of aggregate form.
Yeah, so I agree with all that. So the easiest way is to just call and ask, right? So, like, there's a number of things that you'd find out if you called our company and asked about those sort of things, right? You'd find that we do have a two-factor solution available. You don't see it on the front page of our website. You find that there's also things that if you're really paranoid about your name that we can do to really help to twerk it down, right? Sort of similarly with Matt, right? You can, there's all sorts of things a registrar can do to help you if you really want to be restrictive on that name. Those reduce your operational flexibility and inject very purposeful friction into those kind of things. So you can't just sort of randomly wake up at 3 in the morning in the middle and say, you know, I think I want to update my email address because, you know, I want to shift it from my Yahoo account to my Gmail account, you know. You're probably not going to be able to do that, but you will have much stronger. I mean, the same reason you have a safe deposit box, it's a hassle to go get birth certificates and stuff like that. But the nice thing is that they won't burn down in your house, right, in a fire. You know, as far as, you know, two-factor being broken, my words, not yours, I'm sort of paraphrasing, you know, like Matt said, it's a cat and mouse game, and there's the only completely secure computer is one that's turned off and not connected to a network, right? So, and you know, I don't sell two-factor services. The people that sell two-factor services might have an issue with sort of declaring it, you know, vulnerable, but that's sort of a different. I think that's a different panel. As far as your other question was about the privacy service, we didn't address privacy services here because that's out of bailiwick for this sort of discussion, right? This is about what registrants are doing to protect their account. And so from that standpoint, one of the things that we could have said if we wanted to step into that, because that's sort of fraught with perilous peril, right, privacy services are, and the SSAC is trying to sort of constrain its remit to technical matters, and so consequently, because if we were going to make a comment about privacy, you might actually say that privacy might actually help those things because it makes the registrant a little more secure, hypothetically, right? You could argue that, but that's, privacy services are different discussion entirely, so...
Privacy is a very different discussion from security. I'll leave it at that.
Just a quick follow-up, and I understand it's kind of the third rail. You don't want to go there on the privacy services. On the multi-factor authentication issue, and your point on the only secure computer is one that's not connected to anything, that reminded me of the current guidance, at least in the U.S., is that for doing online transactions of high value, they recommend having a dedicated computer to just doing those transactions. Not a bad thing when you have a portfolio of domains that are worth a whole lot, or you've got a, you know, a corporate environment where you've got to protect that, is to dedicate a single computer. They're so cheap these days. Not a bad idea.
I'll have to bring that up with my wife and see if I can get some funds appropriated here as the fiscal year runs out at our house.
Are there any more questions, comments?
I have some more observations from the chat. Bob Connolly makes another case as an example. CaliforniaDelta.com was used as a community marketing website, and the admin contact died. And by the time the other members woke up to the problem, the domain had reached the delete pool and had been captured by a speculator in Belize. And unfortunately, the speculator never responded to email inquiries. So I think his point is that this is a very useful document for situations such as that. I also have a comment from Jap Acker, house, who mentions that SAC 23 did mention privacy services. So I think that was in response to Richard's comment.
Okay, anyone else? No? I'll say thank you very much. It has been a great experience. The report is fabulous. I actually did read it. And I'll hand over to Vanda to wrap up.
Well, so I believe that's the end of our session. Is everybody hungry? And certainly we have a, you know, touch, I guess, a very broad aspect of this issue here. And there is much more to do that. And I do believe it could be a very normal session in the future ICANN meetings, because there is a lot of progress, a lot of problems that we are going to face, and more nowadays with the people going to cloud computers, and we're going to have a lot of challenge to face. So it's my suggestion that we keep this running during the next meeting, you know, more organized and much more, you know, broad aspects, part of technical, part more social and impact of the society. So thank you very much for your attention. And, you know, Steve wants to start again. So it's open again.
It's not so much to start again, but to participate in the closing. I'm Steve Crocker. I'm chair of ESSAC. My ears are burning. My heart is warm. Thank you very much. I'm glad that you enjoy our work so much, and it's a great pleasure to have been helpful to you guys.
Thank you, Steve. And so let's close again. And thank you again for all of you to being here with us. Thank you for all the speakers, our colleague over there. And all this material will be available for you in our website. So even the contact of the speakers, so you can also make you know, additional questions if you want to. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to add one thing. Everybody, please take this report and disseminate it to everyone you know, because it's really, really important.